You happy with that?
No. It's garbage.
It's not me, it's you.
Oh, God.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hello again, this is Dan Godby, medical editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for the spring 2022 edition of the JSOM podcast. For this issue, I will again identify some articles worth reading that will not be covered by Josh and Alex in the podcast. The first one is Injuries and Interventions on Transported Military Working Dogs within the U.S. Central Command. Given how limited the literature is on military working dog casualties, this article does add a great deal of value given how immature the literature is on this topic. The second one is Advancing the Practice of Contemporary Military Performance Psychology, a Full Spectrum Approach to Psychological Health and Wellness. This discussion is an excellent review of military performance psychology and summarizes a very complex topic in a well-organized manner. As always, we at the JSOM are interested in hearing from our readership, especially those of you in the primary positions. And again, I'd like to reiterate our mentoring program specifically created to help medics get through the publishing process. A select group of editors are dedicated to concentrate on articles submitted by medics and provide assistance in getting the articles published. Now again, here's Josh and Alex with the podcast.
Well, Josh, buddy, it's been a while. So nice to hear you again and looking forward to seeing you soon at SOMSA. Anything new and exciting in your world these days?
I've been recently thinking about surgery and combat environments and things of that nature. And I had gone to a course on medicine in resource-limited environments. And they sort of provided me a interesting mindset shift that when you have nothing, it actually drives creativity and new thought, right? So in the past 20 years, when we've been fighting and we had our trauma system set up overseas, like we had almost everything available and we could call medevac fairly quickly and the surgeons were fairly close and we could get somebody out of theater very quickly and get them back to the States for definitive care. And when you get that sort of trauma system set up, it really benefits the patient in that there's high survivability, but it doesn't benefit the provider so much because it sort of breeds into an idea that I can only go so far down my resources before I have to say we have to stop. Whereas in a resource limited environment, when you have nothing, when you start from zero, you actually develop more creativity, become more agile, you have new and maybe even better ideas on how to deal with problems. And I really appreciated that mindset shift from thinking about everything and using algorithms to solve problems to thinking about, okay, but what if I have nothing? Like, what sort of creative ideas do I need to come up with? What sort of agile thought processes do I need to develop that could maybe benefit my patients to give me, it may not be a perfect solution, but it's a solution that could get them evacuated. Anyways, that's what I've been thinking about for the past couple of days.
Yeah, well put. When I was first in training many, many years ago, a very wise, seasoned, grizzled, and salty trauma surgeon told me something similar, which is that young surgeons know the rules and old surgeons know the exceptions to the rules. And we probably don't need to go into detail too much, but you and I have already spoken recently about the Joint Trauma Service position statement on single surgeon teams. And it is a nuanced paper. It is essentially a position statement. But I think you and I, in chatting previously, have said that it really does feel like a line in the sand, i.e., if we can't follow the rules, we just shouldn't play. And I think that that may be a detriment to our customer, which is the geographic combatant commanders, because as I've learned from many, many much, much smarter special operations supporting surgeons, really the goal is to be creative and solve the problems and not be dogmatically sticking to the clinical algorithms. And I think you've done a really great job highlighting that. Well, Josh, this edition, we're taking a little bit of a deviation from focusing on the studies that are published in the JSOM to do a little bit of a lit review because we think it's so important. So what have you got for us this time?
Yeah, Alex, today we're going to talk about the efficacy of vancomycin powder in mitigating infection of open penetrating trauma wounds on the battlefield, an evidence-based review. The authors are Brett Terbeek, Paul Luce, Timothy Picari, and Dr. David Tennant. So as you said, this is a literature review, and they were looking to fill this gap, and that is the more modern conflicts that we're planning for will likely limit air medical evacuations, which is going to lead to longer than planned holding times for rural and providers. While current practice of broad spectrum IV or PO medications is the current standard of practice, and there is no evidence for this alteration, there may be a role for some topical vancomycin to reduce the gram-positive bacterial burden for blast wounds. This paper is an attempt to look at the current data in the literature to see if there's any support for this practice. So the authors went to PubMed and they reviewed the clinical literature. They performed searches using search terms and phrases, vancomycin powder, combat trauma, infection, TCC and antibiotics, vancomycin and orthopedic and surgery, bacteria and combat and trauma, and osteomyelitis. In current studies that were in progress were also reviewed using the Defense Technical Information Center's PubDefense, and some animal studies were also examined. The authors broke up their paper into several pieces, and they found that, one, osteomyelitis is a real risk to blast trauma patients. And osteomyelitis, Alex, I know you're aware of this, is a very difficult disease to treat, takes long antibiotics, takes many surgical procedures, and sometimes is never quite fully removed. And so this is a big problem when it comes to hospital length of stay and cost of care. They found that some animal model data demonstrated benefits with early vancomycin powder administration on open fractures, and this reduced bacterial load in two studies. And in one study, they found that residual powder was detectable 14 days post-injury. Vancomycin powder was shown to reduce wound complications in new and revision amputations with a low number needed to treat of 8 and 7 respectively. And then they also looked at one specific reported meta-analysis of vancomycin powder used in spine surgery, which showed a reduction of post-op skin and soft tissue infections. But as you know, since vancomycin is effective primarily against gram-positive bacteria, the treated population had an increased incidence of gram-negative infections, which you kind of expect. So in the discussion, the authors talk about the use of vancomycin powder and how it could disrupt gram-positive bacteria's ability to form a biofilm, and this would make the infected tissue much easier to treat. And then early administration on animal models show decreased bacterial counts, suggesting that this may also work for humans. And then lastly, there is wide use in orthopedic and spine surgery literature, suggesting that it improves outcomes and reduces the amount of soft tissue infections. So after reading the study, I thought it was interesting. I would say, though, that the surgical studies that they looked at were primarily retrospective. And while retrospective studies, as long as you understand their limitations, are fine, still contain several limitations. Also, the animal models are not a correlate to human models. It is merely a sign pointing in the direction of possibility, but not necessarily the destination you're looking for. And then, especially in those surgical studies, it's poor generalizability to our population of traumatically injured folks. Now, in their conclusions, they noted there are at least one or two prospective studies in the emergency medicine literature looking at open fractures and vancomycin powder use. So we'll have to see what those come out with in the future. I'd also be interested in what infectious disease has to say about this practice. It really wasn't discussed too much in the paper, but it's something we could look into. What I do appreciate, though, is that vancomycin powder in a traumatically injured patient is almost working the problem in two directions, especially when you consider you giving broad-spectrum IV antibiotics. But that may not reach the area of interest because with the significant injury to the lower extremity, the vasculature is poor, you're not going to get good penetration. If you give the vancomycin powder and it actually has effect, You're actually helping treat the problem, again, from two directions. And then lastly, as the authors have noted, this hasn't been studied. It's going to be very difficult to study this for our particular population. I think we're going to have to depend on the emergency medicine literature to really sort of give us a sense on whether this practice has any sort of applicability to our population. But, you know, I think the paper is well written. I think it makes some pretty good arguments. I think it's worth your reading. What do you got, Alex?
Yeah, I have a sneaking suspicion that this paper came out of one of the weekly Joint Trauma Service presentations about a year or so ago, and I'm really remiss in not remembering the presenter's name, but he basically rocked everybody's mind on that call as far as some of the benefits of vancomycin, especially for some of those challenging patients when you would want a wound vac, but it may not be appropriate, or you don't have the resources, continuing your austere surgery theme. Or as I'm sure you have experienced, even in the hospital, when the wound vac just won't work. He also happened to talk about Dakin solution and how ineffective that is, which has changed my clinical practice. So I'll see if I can find a link to that old one, because that was really just a great presentation. And this was a wonderful amount of literature review data, which is, Josh, what level of evidence for changing practice?
It's not, Alex. We don't change practice on literature reviews.
Yeah, if memory serves correctly, I believe lit review is level 4 evidence. We change practice on level 1 evidence if we can get it, but this might be one of those situations where we just can't get the data. And very excited this edition for our guest editor to have SO1 PJ Palayas, a SEAL medic and instructor at the schoolhouse, and all around great guy. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me back on the podcast, Alex. Today, I'll be reviewing a case control study published in the spring 2022 edition of JSOM. The title of this paper is Feasibility of Obtaining Intraosseous and Intravenous Access Using Night Vision Goggle Focusing Adapters, written by Alexander Itin and his colleagues. The gap in literature that's being addressed is the utility of performing medical procedures under night vision with focusing adapters versus night vision alone versus utilization of a green lens headlamp alone, which I'll now refer to as the three different lighting conditions for the remainder of this review. The author's null hypothesis states that there would be no statistically significant difference between the lighting conditions in success rate or time to completion.
I'm so glad you chose this article, PJ. You know, this is one I had an interest in, and I am really excited that you're actually going to be reviewing this at SOMSA as well. Can you tell us what is it about this article that took your interest?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Alex. I decided to review this article because I've noticed some inconsistencies among special operations medics in regards to providing medical care to casualties in a low-light or no-light environment. I'm interested in pursuing an evidence-based approach in determining when it's more appropriate to utilize headlamps for life-saving interventions or implementing a more stringent standard for medics and their capability to perform certain medical procedures under night vision.
I love it, and I look forward to seeing your scientific project in the future. But getting back to this article, what methods did the authors use?
Yeah, well, in the methods for this study, it took place in a simulation lab at Naval Medical Center, San Diego. The participants of the study were 23 Navy medical personnel, most of which were special operations. All of them had T-tri-C training and familiarization with night vision devices prior to being selected as participants. It is important to note that the participants were ranked to have had an above average level of proficiency with night vision devices and headlamps. However, most of the participants had no experience with focusing adapters. And for those of you listening who are not familiar with night vision focusing adapters, I encourage you to read this paper and find in the methods a rather brief but thorough explanation of the functioning and operation of the adapters. But for now, night vision alone is more adept for infinity distances, which leaves the user at a disadvantage for an out-of-focus image for objects up close. Focusing night vision devices is a relatively tedious and lengthy process that's ideally not done on the battlefield, and night vision focus adapters allow the user to quickly shift focus for images up close and gives the medical provider a more appropriate image needed to perform meticulous medical procedures. Well, the medical procedures tested in this study included IV and IO access on part task trainers and were performed in a universal, step-by-step manner to ensure validity of the results. Each participant performed one attempt for IV and IO in each of the three lighting conditions. Two key quantitative data points were collected for each procedure: time to completion measured in seconds, and successful placement of IV or IO catheter, which was judged by a proctor. Following the procedures, each participant completed a post-test exit survey, which gave the authors qualitative data points on participant confidence with the procedures and their individual user preference for lighting conditions.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading through their methods section. I thought it was incredibly well organized. And what did they find for their results?
In the results, summed up in plain speak, IVs are less successful than IOs, especially if you're trying to start an IV on night vision compared to headlamps, and IOs are faster than IVs regardless of lighting conditions. Night vision adapters appear to have offered a small advantage over night vision alone. The specific results showed statistically significant increased success rates for IV access using headlamp with 74% success versus night vision alone with 35% success. However, night vision with adapters performed better in IVs than night vision alone with a 54% success rate. IO success rate was similar between all three lighting conditions, approximately 98% success. And not surprisingly, time to completion was faster for all IO and IV procedures utilizing headlamp versus night vision alone and night vision with adapters. Finally, the perceived difficulty results showed lower confidence for IO and IV procedures with night vision alone and night vision with adapters compared to headlamp. The authors do note the post-test survey showed 70% of participants would willingly utilize night vision adapters in their future practice.
Outstanding summary. Thanks for giving us that overview. And then in your analysis, what do you think would be some strengths of this manuscript?
Well, I really like the fact that the authors controlled for the vast variability between participants, such as years spent in the military, familiarity with the lighting equipment, and use of night vision or night vision with adapters in operational environments.
And then, as we always do at this point, can you maybe point out some weaknesses to the study?
Yeah, remark of criticism for this paper is the lack of representation in the participant pool from other branches of USSOF medical providers.
Yeah, that's a reasonable analysis, especially considering they're a low N, which is something we often see. So do you think that this study meets the requirements to change clinical practice?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Alex. Overall, I think this paper is about level 3 evidence and not powerful enough to encourage change of practice by itself. However, I do think it raises multiple important questions that can be brought to light for hopeful follow-on studies. Should SOF medics become more proficient with medical procedures utilizing night vision? If a medic needs to obtain access at night on NODs on an urgent patient, should the medic immediately go to obtaining IO access and forego IV access due to lack of initial success? And what are other life-saving interventions that have similarly low success rates under night vision?
Yeah, thanks so much for your outstanding summary, and I hope everybody gets a chance to see your review of this article at SOMSA as well, and really excited that you're taking up this outstanding and important clinical question for the community.
Wounded Warrior Project's mission is to transform the way America's injured veterans are empowered, employed, and engaged in our communities through a variety of free programs and services. One of those programs is Warrior Care Network, which aims to minimize the impact of mental health issues on everyday life. Through a partnership with 4 top academic medical centers around the country, participants receive a year's worth of evidence-based treatments with complementary alternative therapies during a 2 to 3 week intensive outpatient program. Please visit warriorcarenetwork.org to learn more.
All right, and For our next selection, we've got development of a swine polytrauma model in the absence of fluid resuscitation by a potpourri of authors. Is that the right word, maybe? From Baltimore Shock Trauma, as well as Georgetown University School of Medicine. All a number of highly qualified authors here. And essentially summarizing their abstract, what they note is that polytrauma patients in locations where access to resuscitative therapy may be limited present a challenge. There's a pressing need for adjuncts that can be delivered in these settings. To assess these adjuncts, a model representative of this clinical scenario is necessary. And in particular, they do a great job in their background of reminding us that despite huge advancements in extremity hemorrhage control therapies, we still have very, very few options in our toolbox to address the 2/3 of hemorrhage deaths which come from non-compressible truncal hemorrhage. And so, in an effort to create a benchmark which we can then measure future therapies against, they attempted to develop a hemorrhage and polytrauma model in the absence of fluid resuscitation. For their materials and methods, they had two separate sample populations, one that had a pulmonary contusion and that had an N of 6. For that sample population, they applied either 3, 6, or 9 non-penetrating captive bolt gun discharges, with two specimens receiving each of the doses, and then assessing for contusion volumes by CT. The second group of 6 specimens received a composite injury pattern that included a tibial fracture, pulmonary contusion, and controlled hemorrhage at 20, 30, or 40%. The specimens were all observed for 3 hours or until death, and they were assessed using a number of hemodynamic and metabolic parameters. In the isolated chest wall injury sample population, they found a very large and non-statistically significant volume for the pulmonary contusions with a p-value of 0.67. What they did note is that animals who received at least 6 discharges suffered parenchymal lacerations or lung tears. And in the polytrauma and controlled hemorrhage group, what they found is that those specimens who had 40% hemorrhage had 100% mortality at 12 minutes. The 30% hemorrhage had 100% mortality at 115 minutes. And the 20% hemorrhage had 50% mortality at 3 hours. And so their conclusion from this study was that they were able to characterize a titratable hemorrhage and polytrauma model in the absence of fluid resuscitation. And they say this model could be useful in evaluating future resuscitative adjuncts that could be assessed for delivery in remote areas. So Josh, let's get right into our analysis for this, and which of the critical appraisal tools from the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford University will we be using?
Yeah, Alex, we're going to use the Critical Appraisal of Prognostic Studies as provided to us by the University of Oxford and the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine. So, Alex, the first question is, was the defined representative sample of patients assembled at a common, usually early, point in the course of their disease?
Yeah, absolutely. For this controlled study where all of the samples or specimens were pre-selected, that is absolutely true.
Was the patient follow-up sufficiently long and complete?
They had 100% patient follow-up.
Were outcome criteria either objective or applied in a blind fashion?
They were definitively objective.
If subgroups with different prognoses are identified, did adjustment for the important prognostic factors take place?
Yeah, the only prognosis here, I think, was lethality, and so it's more not applicable. But, you know, taking a step back and really assessing what this critical appraisal of prognostic studies is for, it's, are the results of this study valid when assessing for internal validity, which hopefully we'll publish our little synopsis on internal and external validity. But we need to remember that internal validity means, does this porcine model relate to a wider porcine model if they had an appropriate sample size? Versus external validity, which wasn't even assessed here, would determine if this porcine model is directly applicable to a human model. So in that case, they did a great job, but as we'll get into in just a minute here, this is an incredibly small sample size that is only a surrogate for what we're actually looking at applying it to. All right, Josh, and we've now got the albeit belatedly privilege of chatting with one of the primary authors for this article that was actually published in winter, but because of problems, we're finally getting around to having a wonderful chat with Dr. Morrison, who is a vascular and trauma surgeon at Shock Trauma. Sir, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So, sir, really excited to review your manuscript here, and I was also intrigued with your brief bio that you sent us about your previous military experience before hanging up your shingle and joining the medical private sector. Can you tell us about your previous military experience?
Yeah, be delighted. I originally joined the British Army as a reservist in 2003, and I was at medical school at the time, and I remember kind of signing up with a smile on my face because my mother was adamantly against me joining the regular army. But with the kind of tempo of operations just kicking off, I knew that in a reserve unit, I would actually have a way of deploying faster. So I initially joined the reserves and deployed in 2005 in a field hospital in southeast Iraq. And that was kind of my first exposure to combat medicine and surgery and the problems that affect our service personnel, not just on the trauma front, but also the disease non-battle. And just the challenges of doing things in a tent. From there, things got a little bit more serious with commitments in Afghanistan, where you know I deployed in 2008, and then as a full-time reserve service, joined in 2012 for a tour. But the kind of highlight of my career in terms of a research output was at the U.S. Army Institute for Surgical Research for 2 years in 2011-12, where my UK mentor was the professor of surgery at the time, Mark Midwinter, and my US mentor was Todd Rasmussen, who has since remained a strong mentor, advocate, and friend. And, you know, with a lot of those US connections, when I ultimately separated from the military, I, you know, had a great privilege of coming back to the US and where I am now, practicing in Baltimore in a trauma setting there.
I really love the full circle component of your story. And you know, we hadn't chatted about this earlier, but we do have a number of listeners who are either soft medics considering going to med school or former soft medics who are in med school and are considering their residency options. And as most folks know, I have previously said that the best insurance policy you can have on the battlefield, short of good armor and high velocity firepower, is a vascular trauma surgeon. Having one of those around on the battlefield makes me feel as warm and cozy as being wrapped in pre-warmed surgery blankets after the PACI setting. So could you maybe do a quick elevator pitch for someone in medical school who is considering a residency and why they should go for a vascular trauma exposure like you've got?
Oh, my goodness. Well, vascular trauma, I think, is the ultimate in insurance policy for a whole manner of things. And I mean that both in military terms and also civilian terms. Bleeding is something that is germane to so many specialties, from the world of obstetrics, gynecology, through to the world of general surgery, you know, through to big blood vessel sport with vascular surgery. So it's something that's common across a lot of specialties and is that unexpected emergency that arises. Often somebody needs to be called, and I think a lot of people think of the vascular surgeons as kind of operating room firefighters, where really they provide a critical component to getting hemostasis in often dire emergencies. And if emergency surgery is something that appeals to you, then I would really encourage somebody to take a general surgical residency and then progressing down a vascular route, because it gives you an exposure to a multitude of areas to operate in and a comfort that in an emergency really, really counts. And quite often it's those in-the-moment decisions that have a huge impact on downstream patient effects. And I don't just mean mortality, I also mean, you know, issues of morbidity in terms of salvaging legs and various things. So I think that the vascular trauma surgeon, I think, is kind of one of the most holistic specialties out there. And I know that a lot of people will giggle to hear a surgeon talk about holistic things, but that's kind of very much how I feel about, you know, the tribe that I have come to call my own. But that's what I would encourage. And it gives you a level of surgical confidence that is, you know, that you really start to appreciate when the chips are down.
Yeah, fair enough. And if I can foot stomp to all the listeners who are planning to go to SOMSA, or if you are not, please do consider going. I did just see that Dr. Jigar Patel is doing a after-action review in the osteoresuscitative surgery track for the Kabul MassCal, and he happens to be one heck of a vascular trauma surgeon who was there. He's also just an incredibly nice guy, and I'm sure it's going to be an outstanding presentation. But Dr. Morrison, moving on, we sure enjoyed reviewing your manuscript, and we were left with a couple of questions for you that we were hoping you might be able to help expand on some answers and educate some of our soft medics about. So our first question was, pigs, as we know, are more coagulopathic than humans, and we're wondering how you accounted for this in your study.
Great question, and that has an enormous amount of relevance in relation to the translation of these models. One of the huge benefits of kind of in vivo modeling of injury is that you get a whole body appreciation of how physiology responds to both injury and therapy, but often that comes with important things to factor in. And in the context of coagulation within swine model, although the pig has the same clotting cascade as humans, they have a relative increase in certain factors. So, for example, they're much more pro-coagulant than humans. And that's important both in this study and in the broader context of trauma modeling. In the broader context, I would always, when you're looking at an article, I'd always critically think about whether or not the authors are overrepresenting their data when testing novel hemostatic agents like gauzes and tourniquets, because often the pig will stop bleeding relatively easily because they're a prey animal and their coagulation cascade is kind of always on edge. In the context of our model paper, we tried to take that into account by administering a little bit of heparin. We did that for a couple of reasons. One, to try and have their coagulation cascade more in line with a kind of sensitivity that you would see in a human patient, but also maybe to introduce a little bit of coagulopathy even. But also our instrumentation, we found with putting large bore cannulas in large veins that often in the process of in the induction of shock, the slow withdrawal of blood will result in thrombosis of the cannulas, and therefore you're then unable to continue to venesect. So we found that the introduction of a little bit of heparin, just in the order of around about 100 units a kilogram, was sufficient to offset that. So that's how we dealt with that particular problem. But that's something that's very important to look at in the context of this sort of trauma modeling.
What a great point. Thank you so much for bringing up the issue of expanding your mitigation factor to even other articles and other products even. Yeah, great point for soft medics to take into account. Our next question is, we did see in your manuscript that you used isoflurane for your anesthesia, and as we all know well, that does tend to cause hypotension. We're wondering how you accounted for the anesthetic-related hypotension in your hemorrhagic trauma model.
That's another great question that both speaks to issues relating to trauma modeling in general as well as this study. One of the things that I think is really important for listeners to be aware of is that the induction of hypotension does not translate to hemorrhagic shock. In that, how I tend to think about hemorrhagic shock is kind of similar to sepsis, where, you know, you've got some specific definitions where, you know, with sepsis you can have all of the features in terms of a temperature and a raised white count, but unless you've got, you know, a failure in response to resuscitation, you don't have severe sepsis. And I kind of think, I use that as a, what I think is a helpful way of how I equate that to hemorrhagic shock, where it's not just having a low blood pressure, it's also having a raised lactate, and that you're trying to demonstrate that there is actually end organ malperfusion. And that's something that, you know, we specifically looked for in our study, in our lactates, in our 40% hemorrhage group, kind of got up to three, which isn't a great deal. Certainly in subsequent work where we've used this model, we've been able to generate lactates in the kind of 6 to 8 region. So when looking at your anesthetic type, what you mustn't do is confuse your over administration of anesthesia, especially as you end up with a reducing circulating volume. So your anesthetic that you're giving is distributed over a smaller volume. You mustn't mistake that for shock. And that's why I would always look for another marker of end organ malperfusion. And I would say that lactate's probably lactate, potassium, these sorts of things are good markers of a body that's genuinely struggling. So really what we did was we paid careful attention to the anesthetic, specifically during the induction of shock. So as we withdrew blood volume, we looked at reducing the amount of anesthetic that was on board. We always do this extremely carefully and with veterinary oversight, because you have to balance the fact that the anesthetic is there for a purpose, but it absolutely does and can compromise results just purely by vasodilation and afterload reduction. So a lot of it is simply about titrating your anesthetic to an appropriate stimulus and watching the animal carefully and looking for evidence of end organ malperfusion in your model.
Oh boy, I think that's going to give some of our listeners something to go hit the books and review about, which is wonderful. Our next question is, the empiric placement of chest tubes to prevent pneumothorax in your model seems quite reasonable, but we're wondering, what if these specimens should have died of tension physiology before the thoracic hemorrhage that you were studying?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I think a lot of that comes down to the purpose and aim of your modeling study, in that we were specifically looking to generate a polytrauma model with three injury components. And what we didn't want to do is have other confounders that would compromise, you know, that particular experimental method. In that the aim of the experiment wasn't to look at the incidence of pneumothorax. And in fact, the issue of pneumothoraces came up with our CT scanning. And it was clear that we were, you know, generating some of that. And then we developed anxiety ourselves that we, with positive pressure ventilation, would artificially create a tension pneumothorax, especially as we were seeing tears in the lung post-mortem. So that led to the prophylactic maneuver of putting in a chest tube, because what we didn't want was having a series of animals succumbing to tension physiology, especially if, as we've gone on to use this model in a therapeutic study, what we didn't want to do was have those results confounded where either animals were not in shock, they were in fact having a tension pneumothorax. So it's all about reducing confounders.
Well, that does a really great job about explaining a little bit better about what your goals were with the study. And so that'll lead into our next question, which we often have with a number of these very difficult to obtain animal studies, which is, with a small sample of 6 specimens with overlapping results, are your conclusions reasonable, or should this be considered maybe a pilot study ahead of an appropriately powered experiment?
That's a great question, and that's the eternal dilemma with this sort of work. What we endeavor to do is a kind of block design, where a fairly ambitious model where we were trying to create something that had a high level of clinical relevance. So it had the soft tissue component and the hard tissue component of the open fracture. You had the pulmonary issue as well as the hemorrhage. And many models, especially those that are of controlled hemorrhage, do not have anywhere near the inflammatory component that this sort of polytrauma model had. And therefore, when it comes to testing therapeutic adjuncts, especially those that have some semblance of autoimmune or immune function, you don't get adequate results. So what we endeavored to do with how we set this study up was to look at each component and figure out the variability that we had with that piece. So the open fracture was the simplest part, in that we either generated an open fracture or we didn't. That was a binary fracture, yes or no. The greater challenge was with delivering the contusion and knowing how much contusion to deliver, and also to have an endpoint for how we were measuring that contusion. And then the third part was obviously the hemorrhage. And we figured, coming from a hemorrhage control and resuscitation lab, that we would have the best handle on the effect of bleeding. So we started with the pulmonary contusion, and we used non-contrast CT to measure the size of that so that we actually had an objective measure, and then really titrated our mortality effect to that, and then added in the hemorrhage and just kind of ballpark guessed how that would work out. We did all that in a kind of slow, progressive way with our six animals. And the minute that we had a sense of signal, we felt that that was then adequate. We felt fairly confident with how the model was going to behave. But the point that you make about this being very much a pilot study is well taken. And that's why we've gone on to then use this model in work to explore a drug called estradiol and its effects on hemorrhage. So yes, you're absolutely right in that most of the data that we present in our JCL model paper is very much non-statistically significant but trend data rather than, you know, large numbers with clear significance. And the reason being is to try and be smart about how we do that to minimize the number of animals while still getting the tuning of the model that we needed for the bigger study that we've since gone on to complete.
Yeah, and we spoke a little bit ahead of the recording about that. So our next question is, are there plans to continue this particular study to try and standardize other injury patterns in the absence of resuscitation? And I think you mentioned that you had a rather significant recent publication as well in that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of aims. You know, there's the bigger aim of the lab and the development of a portfolio of models that one can adjust. So having that model that you can say, well, if you need more of a pro-inflammatory component versus a hemodynamic instability component, then one can tune your model appropriately. So there's the long-term plan of having a portfolio of models for the lab. But then there's also the specific purpose that this model has been conceived for. And in this case, it was to evaluate a drug called 17-alpha-ethyl-estradiol-3-sulfate, which is a water-soluble estradiol, which has some exciting potential in ameliorating hemorrhagic shock. And since then, we've gone on to do a study where we've randomized animals to five different doses of estradiol in the context of that polytrauma model, and then looked at both outcome in terms of mortality, but also outcome in terms of inotropy and the effect on the heart. And we just published that in the Journal of Trauma earlier this year.
And for those lucky few listeners who have a institutional subscription to the Journal of Trauma, could you maybe give us the title of that paper so they could dig into that a little bit further?
Yeah, absolutely. An estrogen 17-alpha ethyl estradiol 3-sulfate reduces mortality in a swine model of multiple injuries and hemorrhagic shock. And the lead author is Hossam Abdou, who is the research resident who also is the lead author on this model paper.
Oh boy, I expect many wonderful things from your guys' shop. And so our last question for you is a little bit of an extra that you and I chatted about ahead of time, but full credit where credit is due. My co-editor, Josh, came up with this one. He said, you do an excellent job reporting hemodynamic data and laboratory data. However, did you measure core temperature across the animals to ensure that hypothermia didn't play a role in your coagulopathy study?
So that's a great question. And we very much wanted to, you know, as with the chest tube, eliminate that as a confounding variable. So we actively warmed the animals. And yes, we did measure core temperature to make sure that we didn't slip below 37. Pigs generally have a slightly higher core temperature, around about 38. And curiously, they're also often prone to malignant hyperthermia, but that's a different discussion. But yes, we were able to say, and I'm slightly embarrassed that you guys picked up on that and we didn't include that data. We ultimately have a data collection system that is pretty comprehensive, and that often the biggest problem we have is trying to distill through this huge body of numbers and you know, piecing together what tells the relevant story. But that's a great point.
Wonderful. Well, sir, I sure appreciate your time and insight. This is a great manuscript that looks to directly address a huge issue, which is not only hemorrhagic shock, but also a A2AD PCC environment in which medics and medical providers may not have access to adequate resuscitation fluid. I look forward to seeing many more good products from you and your team to try and save our service members out at the tip of the spear.
Likewise, much appreciated. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
All right, Alex, I think we covered it all. And besides, I'm coming up on my dose of ivermectin that I need to take here in a little bit for my COVID. So I think we need to cut this one short.
Science and the rest of humanity hates you, my friend.
Well, speaking of science, isn't there a big meeting coming up here in a little bit?
Would you perchance be referring to the Special Operations Medical Scientific Assembly in Raleigh next month?
That is exactly what I'm referring to.
I am so excited to hopefully see all of our friends there again. We, and by that I mean the Royal We, will be presenting in a couple of different tracks and really looking forward to chatting with folks, getting some feedback. And please do feel free to come up and holler at us, slap us upside the head, or whatever form of informal communication and feedback you've got to offer for us.
Yeah, absolutely. We really appreciate your guys' feedback. It drives change and lets us know what we need to do better.
Well, brother, look forward to seeing you there and hopefully some of our colleagues as well.
All right, Alex.
Toodles.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers and welcome your feedback and suggestions.